A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
You know how every self-help shelf these days has a book telling you to take control of your thoughts, rewire your brain, stop believing the voice in your head? It sounds like wisdom from nowhere. But it actually has a paper trail. A specific traceable lineage from a psychiatrist in Philadelphia in the early 1960s, through some fierce academic debates about whether you should challenge a thought's truth or just its usefulness, all the way to the life coaching apps people are tapping on right now. And Daniel sent us a prompt that digs right into that history.
The timing matters more than people realize. The life coaching industry is projected to hit $20 billion by 2027. That's according to an IBIS World Report from last year. The core methodology millions of people are being taught, the circumstance to thought, to feeling-to-action model, is being adopted without most people knowing it's a direct descendant of clinical cognitive therapy. There's a whole intellectual genealogy here.
Daniel's been reading Cara Lowenthal's book, Take Back Your Brain, and he's asking us to do two things. First, map her mental model back onto its clinical ancestor. Where does this fit in the evolution of cognitive behavioral therapy, and how practitioners have learned to help people understand their own cognitive loops? And second, at the implementation level, what frameworks actually exist in the life coaching world that operationalize these ideas? What are people doing with this stuff day to day?
Before we dive in, quick note. DeepSeek V4 Pro is writing our script today.
Keeping us on our toes.
So let's start with the model itself, because the framework Daniel's asking about has a very specific shape. Lowenthal teaches what she calls the CTF-AR model. Circumstance, thought, feeling, action, result. A circumstance is a neutral fact, something everyone in the room would agree on. It's raining. My boss didn't say good morning. I got an email at 5 p.m. The thought is your interpretation of that fact. She's mad at me. I'm in trouble. The feeling is the emotional response that thought generates. Anxiety, shame, anger. The action is what you do because of that feeling. Avoid your boss. Send an apologetic email you didn't need to send. And the result is the outcome that reinforces the whole loop.
The part that's genuinely interesting here is that the circumstance is supposed to be something that can't be argued. A camera could record it. That's the test she gives. If you can't film it, it's not a circumstance, it's a thought.
And that distinction, the separation of objective fact from interpretation, is where the whole history lives. Because if you go back to the clinical roots, that separation wasn't always there. Or rather, it was handled very differently.
That's the model Daniel wants us to trace. Where does it actually come from?
The first thing to know is that what Lowenthal is doing with that CTFAR chain looks a lot like classic cognitive behavioral therapy's cognitive triangle, but it's got a key addition. The classic CBT model, the one Ehrenbeck developed, has 3 points: thought, emotion, behavior. That's it. Your thought creates an emotion, which drives a behavior, which reinforces the thought. It's a closed loop.
In the clinical version, the starting point is the thought itself. There's no separate box for the thing that actually happened.
And that's the coaching innovation. Lowenthal adds circumstance as a separate objective layer before the thought. In Beck's original framework, the therapist would ask, "What went through your mind when you felt that wave of anxiety?" And the patient might say, "My boss walked past me without speaking." But Beck wouldn't treat that as a neutral fact separate from the interpretation. He'd treat the whole package, the boss walking past, plus the meaning the patient assigned to it, as the automatic thought to be examined.
Which means the clinical model collapses what the coaching model carefully separates. And that separation is doing real philosophical work. It's telling you there's a world out there that just is, and then there's the story you tell about it. Those are different categories of thing.
And the reason this matters for the history we're about to trace is that this distinction, whether you treat the triggering event as part of the cognition or as something external and objective, that's a genuine fork in the road between clinical CBT and what life coaching eventually built on top of it. So here's how we're going to approach Daniel's question. First, we're going to map Lowenthal's model backward onto the actual historical development of cognitive therapy. Beck's automatic thoughts, Ellis's ABC model, the third wave stuff like acceptance and commitment therapy. We'll see where each piece of CTFAR actually came from.
Then once we've got the clinical lineage clear, we'll survey the coaching frameworks that have operationalized this. Byron Katie's four questions, Martha Beck's integrity work, the whole ecosystem of apps and worksheets and daily practices that turned a clinical methodology into something people do with their morning coffee.
I think the most useful thing we can offer is clarity on what's different between these approaches, because they look similar on the surface. A thought leads to a feeling, leads to an action. But what you do with the thought, once you've identified it, whether you challenge its truth or just choose a more useful one, that's where the paths diverge. And that divergence has a history we can trace back to the 1960s.
Let's start with a psychiatrist in Philadelphia who noticed something about his depressed patients that nobody else was paying attention to.
That psychiatrist was Aaron Beck at the University of Pennsylvania. He was trained as a psychoanalyst, which was the dominant framework at the time. But in the late 1950s and early 60s, he started noticing something that didn't fit the Freudian model. His depressed patients weren't just experiencing unconscious anger turned inward, which was the psychoanalytic explanation. They were having streams of automatic negative thoughts. Specific, identifiable, repetitive thoughts that popped up without any conscious effort.
This was a radical observation at the time. The idea that you could just ask someone what they were thinking and get clinically useful information, that wasn't how analysis worked. Analysis was about uncovering what you didn't know you were thinking.
Beck published his first paper on this in 1963, Thinking and Depression, where he identified what he called idiosyncratic cognitive content in depressed patients. They were just sad. They were thinking things like, I'm worthless, nothing ever works out for me, I'm a burden. And these thoughts had a pattern. They were automatic, plausible to the patient, and they tended to be distorted in predictable ways. By 1979, he published the first full cognitive therapy manual, but the core insight was already there in that 63 paper.
Beck's move was to say, let's treat these thoughts as hypotheses, not as facts, which is where his concept of collaborative empiricism comes in. The therapist and patient become detectives together, examining the evidence for and against the automatic thought.
This is where the mapping gets really concrete. Beck developed a list of cognitive distortions, the specific ways automatic thoughts get twisted. Catastrophizing, where you assume the worst possible outcome. Mind reading, where you believe you know what others are thinking without evidence. Labeling, where you attach a global negative label to yourself based on one event. All or nothing thinking. Emotional reasoning, where you treat feelings as facts.
If we take Lowenthal's CTFAR model and lay Beck's distortions over it, the thought step is exactly where these distortions live. The circumstance is, my boss didn't say good morning. The thought is, I'm in trouble. That's mind reading. You're claiming to know what your boss is thinking without any evidence. And the feeling that follows, anxiety or dread, feels completely justified because the thought feels true.
That's the trap. The thought feels like a direct perception of reality rather than an interpretation. Beck's insight was that these thoughts are automatic and they feel true, but they're not transparent windows onto the world. They're constructed, and the construction process can go wrong in systematic ways.
Now, before Beck, there was another figure who was working on a very similar problem from a different angle. Albert Ellis, who was developing Rational Emotive Behavior Therapy, or REBT. And Ellis had his own model that looks a lot like what eventually became CTFAR.
Ellis's ABC model. A is the activating event. B is your belief about that event. C is the consequence, the emotional and behavioral result. And here's the thing. Ellis published this in the late 1950s, actually a few years before Beck's first paper. So in some ways, the ABC model is the direct ancestor of Lowenthal's circumstance to thought-to-feeling chain. Activating event maps onto circumstance. Belief maps onto thought. Consequence maps onto feeling plus action.
Ellis was even more confrontational than Beck about what you should do with the thought. His approach was called disputing. You'd take the irrational belief, like, I must be approved of by everyone I meet, and you'd aggressively challenge it. Is there any evidence for this? Is there a law of the universe that says this must be true? What's the worst that could actually happen?
which is fascinating because this is where we can see the philosophical fork emerging. Ellis believed in disputing the thought's validity. Is this belief rational? Is it true? If not, replace it with a more rational one. Beck also emphasized examining the evidence, testing the thought against reality, but both of them, fundamentally, were concerned with truth. Is this thought accurate?
The coaching world took a different path. Lowenthal's framework, and a lot of the coaching models that followed, they don't necessarily ask whether the thought is true. They ask whether it's useful. Is this thought serving you? Could you choose a different thought that would produce a better feeling and a better result?
That's the split in a nutshell. Clinical CBT asks, is this thought accurate? Coaching asks, is this thought helpful? And you can see why this happened. In a clinical setting, you're treating conditions like depression and anxiety disorders, where the thoughts are often demonstrably false or distorted. A depressed patient who thinks, I am completely worthless, has a thought that can be challenged with evidence. But in coaching, you're often working with high-functioning people whose thoughts aren't clinically distorted, they're just limiting. I'm not ready to start that business isn't necessarily false, it might be true, but it's not useful if the goal is to start the business.
Let's make this concrete with the example Daniel asked about. Take the thought, I failed that presentation. A classic CBT thought record would have you write down the situation, the automatic thought, the emotion it generated, and then systematically examine the evidence. What's the evidence that I failed? What's the evidence that I didn't? Am I confusing a single moment of stumbling with total failure? Am I discounting the parts that went well? The goal is to arrive at a more balanced, evidence-based thought.
And a coaching thought model worksheet from Lowenthal's framework would handle it differently. You'd start by separating the circumstance from the thought. The circumstance is, I gave a presentation and stumbled on slide 7. That's what the camera captured. The thought is, I failed that presentation. Then you'd ask, what feeling does that thought create? Probably shame or discouragement. What action do you take from that feeling? Maybe you avoid volunteering for future presentations. What's the result? You don't improve your public speaking, and your career stagnates. Then the coaching move is, what thought could you choose instead that would create a better result? I learned something about pacing on slide 7. That thought, whether it's the whole truth or not, leads to a feeling of curiosity, an action of practicing, and a result of getting better.
That's the trade-off laid bare. The CBT approach might lead you to a nuanced, accurate thought. Parts of the presentation went well, and I stumbled once, which is normal. That's probably true. But it might not be as motivating as the coaching thought. I learned something valuable. The coaching thought might be slightly rose-tinted, but it produces forward motion.
There's a third wave to this history, too, and it complicates the picture in an interesting way. In the 1980s, Stephen Hayes developed Acceptance and Commitment Therapy, or ACT. And ACT doesn't ask you to challenge the thought's truth or to replace it with a more useful one. It asks you to change your relationship to the thought entirely. Instead of, I failed that presentation, being something to argue with or swap out, it becomes something to notice and diffuse from. You might say to yourself, I'm having the thought that I failed that presentation. That little bit of distance, that ability to see the thought as just a mental event rather than a description of reality, that's the ACT move.
Which is arguably the most radical of the three approaches. Beck and Ellis say, let's fix the thought. Lowenthal says, let's swap the thought for a better one. Hayes says, let's stop treating thoughts as things that need fixing or swapping at all. Just notice them and let them pass.
Here's where the evidence picture gets important. We have really solid clinical trial data for traditional CBT. The 2018 meta-analysis by Hoffman and colleagues, published in JAMA Psychiatry, looked at CBT for anxiety disorders and found an effect size of 0.71. That's substantial. That means CBT works, and it works well for conditions where thoughts had become clinically distorted.
The coaching adaptations, the thought models, and worksheets and apps, they haven't been put through that same kind of rigorous testing. There was a 2023 study in Frontiers in Psychology that looked at coaching interventions using cognitive models, and it found an effect size of 0.42 on well-being, which is something, it's not nothing, but it's notably lower than the clinical CBT numbers and with much higher variability. Some people got a lot out of it, some got very little.
That variability is the part that doesn't get talked about enough in the coaching world. The framework works for some populations and not for others. If someone has a history of trauma, for example, the whole idea of choosing a more useful thought can feel like gaslighting yourself. If the circumstance itself is contested, if what's objective isn't actually agreed upon, the model starts to creak.
Which brings us to the next piece of this. Once you've got the clinical lineage and the philosophical split clear, the question becomes how the coaching world actually implements this stuff. What do people do with the CTFAR model on a Tuesday morning? And to get at that, it helps to look at the people who actually built these coaching frameworks.
Byron Katie is probably the most direct bridge between the clinical tradition and the self-help world. Her method is called The Work, and it's essentially four questions you ask yourself about any stressful thought. Is it true? Can you absolutely know that it's true? How do you react when you believe that thought? Who would you be without that thought?
Then the turnaround, which is the part I find most interesting. You take the original thought and you invert it. My boss doesn't respect me becomes I don't respect my boss, or I don't respect myself. It's a deceptively simple move, but it forces you to consider that the problem might not be where you think it is.
Katie's lineage traces directly back to the same questions Beck and Ellis were asking, but she stripped out the clinical setting entirely. No therapist, no diagnosis, no 12-session protocol. Just a worksheet and four questions. And people do it in their kitchens. That's the coaching innovation, the democratization of cognitive tools that used to require a trained professional.
Martha Beck, who is a sociologist by training, not a clinician, took a different angle. Her framework is what she calls the integrity cleanse, where you treat thoughts as something closer to lies that your social conditioning has planted in you. The goal isn't to examine the thought. It's to identify it as not yours in the first place, then eject it.
Which brings us to Lowenthal's specific contribution. She frames the whole CTFAR model through an explicitly feminist lens. The brain, in Take Back Your Brain, isn't just any brain, it's a brain that's been socialized by patriarchy. The automatic thoughts she's targeting aren't random cognitive distortions. They're specifically the ones women are taught to have. I'm too much. I'm not enough. I should be more accommodating.
This is where her version of the model adds something the clinical tradition didn't emphasize. Beck was focused on individual cognitive processes. Lowenthal is saying, yes, the thought is in your head, but the origin of that thought is systemic. You didn't spontaneously develop the belief that your value comes from pleasing others. That was installed.
The systemic layer changes how you implement the model. In classic CBT, you challenge the thought's accuracy. In Lowenthal's version, you might acknowledge the thought is an accurate reflection of what society taught you, but you still get to decide whether to keep running that program.
How does this actually look in practice? The coaching world has operationalized this into daily tools. You draw a line down a page. Left side, circumstance. Right side, thought. And you practice separating them. The Clarity app, which is built around Byron Katie's method, walks you through the four questions interactively. There's a whole ecosystem of journaling prompts designed around this one cognitive move.
The contrast with clinical CBT is stark when you look at the delivery model. Clinical CBT is structured, typically 12 to 20 sessions, with a trained therapist who's done supervised practicum hours. There's homework between sessions, thought records, and behavioral experiments, and the therapist reviews them with you. The coaching model is often a one-time course purchase, a book, an app subscription. You're doing the work solo.
Which connects back to that Frontiers in Psychology finding about the 0.42 effect size and the high heterogeneity. When you remove the trained human from the loop and hand someone a worksheet, the results get more variable. Some people are really good at identifying their own cognitive distortions. Others, not so much.
There's a deeper problem with the circumstance innovation that we haven't fully unpacked. Lowenthal's test is that a circumstance should be filmable, something a camera could capture. It is raining. My boss said the words we need to talk. The idea is that this creates an objective anchor that can't be argued with.
Critics have pointed out that for a lot of people's actual problems, the circumstance itself is contested. Take someone in a toxic workplace. The circumstance isn't, my boss said these words. The circumstance is a pattern of behavior over months. Is that filmable? But you have to interpret the pattern to name it, and interpretation is exactly what the thought step is supposed to handle.
Or take imposter syndrome, which is one of the classic coaching use cases. Let's walk through the concrete example. Someone gets a job, a good one, one they applied for and interviewed for and were selected for. The circumstance in the coaching model is, I got the job. That's filmable. The offer letter exists. The thought is, I don't deserve this job. That's the imposter thought. The feeling is anxiety. The action is overworking to avoid being found out. The result is burnout.
The coaching move would be to choose a more useful thought. I am capable of learning what this job requires. That produces a feeling of curiosity, an action of asking questions and developing skills, a result of actually growing into the role. Which sounds great. But the CBT clinician would do something different. They'd say, let's examine the evidence for and against the belief that you don't deserve this job. What were the qualifications? Did you meet them? Did the hiring committee, which had access to other candidates, choose you? Why might a competent person still feel like an imposter?
That's where the approaches diverge in their outcome. The coaching approach might get you to functional faster. You swap the thought and you move forward. The CBT approach might take longer, but it might also produce a deeper shift, because you haven't just replaced the thought, you've actually changed your belief about what the evidence says.
Neither is wrong, exactly. They're optimized for different things. The coaching model is optimized for action and momentum. The clinical model is optimized for accuracy and depth. And which one you need probably depends on how stuck you are and what the stakes are.
Lowenthal's feminist framing adds another dimension here. She'd argue that for women especially, the evidence approach can backfire because the evidence has been shaped by the same patriarchal systems that installed the thought. If you look for evidence that you deserve the job, you might find a performance review that says you're doing well. But if your internalized standard is perfection, a good review won't feel like enough. The thought isn't responding to evidence. It's responding to a standard that was set before you ever walked in the room.
Which is why her version of the model treats the thought as something to be chosen rather than something to be proven. It's not about whether the thought is true. It's about whether you want to live inside the reality that thought creates.
If someone's listening and thinking, okay, I want to actually try this, where do they start? The model itself is the diagnostic tool. You write down a situation, and you force yourself to separate what's filmable from what's interpretation. That gap, the space between circumstance and thought, that's where cognitive flexibility lives. Most people never even notice there's a gap.
The gap is usually tiny. My boss didn't say good morning to, I'm in trouble, happens in milliseconds. You don't feel yourself making the leap, you just land in the feeling. Writing it down slows the whole thing down enough to see the leap happened at all.
For the people who want more rigor, the Beck Institute makes their cognitive distortions list available for free. You can literally print it out and keep it next to your journal. When you identify the thought, you check it against the list. Is this catastrophizing? Labeling the distortion gives you some distance from it.
The list itself is almost like a field guide to your own mental wildlife. Once you learn to spot all-or-nothing thinking in the wild, you start seeing it everywhere. In your own head, in other people's arguments, in headlines. It's a transferable skill.
Here's something a listener could actually try for a week. A 7-day experiment. Each day, pick one recurring negative thought, the kind that shows up regularly. Day 1, challenge its truth. Do the full CBT move. What's the evidence for it? What's the evidence against it? What would you tell a friend who had this thought?
Day 2, take the same thought and don't argue with it at all. Just ask, is this useful? What does believing this thought make me do? What would be a more useful thought to hold instead? Then choose that one and act from it.
Alternate the approaches across the week. Some thoughts will respond better to one than the other. A thought like, I'm bad at public speaking, might crumble under the evidence approach because you can find counterexamples. A thought like, I should be further along by now, might not budge with evidence, but you can recognize it's not useful and choose a different yardstick.
The point of the experiment isn't to pick a winner between the clinical approach and the coaching approach. It's to build your own sense of which tool fits which problem. Most people default to one style or the other without ever trying both deliberately. That brings me to something I keep coming back to. We've got this model that works, at least for some people some of the time, and it's being encoded into apps and chatbots. Wobot is the obvious example. It's built on CBT principles. It walks you through thought records. But can you actually teach a chatbot to distinguish a circumstance from a thought?
That's the crux of it. Wobot and similar tools do fine when the user already has some insight and can label things themselves. But the moment you hit an edge case, someone says, My circumstance is that my marriage is failing. A therapist would stop and ask what that means. What's actually happening? A chatbot takes my marriage is failing as the input and starts working from there. But that's not a filmable circumstance. That's already a thought, already an interpretation.
Loenthal's whole model depends on that initial separation being clean. If the circumstance you feed into the chain is already contaminated with interpretation, everything downstream compounds the error. The feeling you get, the action you take, the result you produce, all of it is built on a foundation that wasn't actually a circumstance.
Human coaches are trained to catch that. They hear my marriage is failing, and they say, okay, what specifically happened? What would a camera have recorded? The chatbot doesn't have that judgment. It doesn't know what it doesn't know.
Which means the automation works best for people who already have the cognitive skill the model is trying to teach. It's a paradox. The people who most need help separating circumstances from thoughts are the people least able to provide clean circumstances to an app.
The next frontier complicates this even further. Both the clinical and coaching worlds are starting to integrate somatic approaches, the idea that the body's felt sense is a data point that arrives before the thought. Polyvagal theory, Stephen Porges' work, is the framework here. The idea is that your nervous system detects safety or threat before your prefrontal cortex has time to construct a thought about it.
Now the chain isn't circumstance to thought to feeling. It's circumstance to body sensation to thought to feeling. And that body sensation might be telling you something the thought hasn't caught up to yet. Your stomach tightens before you consciously think this situation isn't safe.
Which means the coaching model and the clinical model both have to account for something that isn't cognitive at all. You can't challenge the truth of a tight chest. You can't ask if a racing heart is useful. The body is just giving you information, and the skill becomes interpreting that information without letting it drive the whole bus.
That's where I think the really interesting work is going to happen over the next few years. Not just teaching people to examine their thoughts, but teaching them to notice what their body knows before the thought even forms. That's a harder skill to put in an app.
Harder, but not impossible. There are already wearables that track heart rate variability as a proxy for nervous system state. The question is whether we can build tools that help people connect those signals to their cognitive patterns without oversimplifying either one.
If listeners take one thing from this whole conversation, maybe it's this. The gap we keep talking about, the space between what happened and what you made it mean, that gap is where everything interesting lives. And noticing it is a skill you can build, whether you do it with a therapist, a coach, an app, or just a notebook and a pen.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The average cumulus cloud weighs about 1.1 million pounds, roughly the same as 100 elephants.
Right.
That's going to make me look at the sky differently.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you got something out of this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps other people find the show.
You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com. We're back next week.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.